From deep in the Swedish forest, the only individualist radio program in Europe, this is VSI Radio International. Not when truth is dirty, but when it is shallow, that the lover of knowledge is reluctant to step into its waters. Stepping out of the shallowness of European cultural thought, this is the voice of the sovereign individual. My name is Paul Lambert. I remember as a child of about 8 years old, in an attempt to seem more grown up, that I began feigning an interest in the local newspaper. My family had it delivered to the house daily, and my father would typically read it before dinner. While I can't say I remember if I was really looking for any real story in particular at any given time, I did make a conscious decision to take everything I read seriously, as I certainly got an impression from the way my father read the newspaper that it was all very important. I remember the impression the editorials on the front page gave me. While I don't remember any piece in particular, I do remember the sense I got of these opinions being so compelling, not by the power of any argument presented, which I barely understood anyway, but rather how sure these opinionators were about their positions. The tone in which such pieces were written reminded me of the scoldings my mother would give me, or the stern warnings my father would give me, at any given time. However, the newspaper editorials were not addressed to young children, but to high-ranking officials in government, both locally and internationally. Frankly, as a young boy, I was really impressed. These writers were teaching what seemed to be obvious lessons and even telling us what the President of the United States or Prime Minister of Britain should do. I really thought such people to be very smart. Of course, keep in mind, that was the evaluation of an 8-year-old boy. As I grew older, I was better able to absorb the editorials, and I could find that there were some issues with which I agreed and others that I did not. By the age of 11 or so, I took a sort of pride in being able to follow the arguments presented, and I felt equal to the writers in addressing whatever topic they chose to bring up. However, as time went on, my initial astonishment with how clever I thought these people were started to fade. Eventually, I got to a point that I gave them the benefit of the doubt that they were smart, but perhaps their experiences led them simply to see things differently than I did, and I resigned to the notion that reasonable people may differ. Yet, as time went on and I became familiar with rhetorical concepts such as ad hominem and the straw man phenomenon, I became less and less impressed with editorials, and more often than not, found myself thinking about vital points and facts that the opinionator missed, and eventually I became apt at picking apart opinion pieces with just as much scrutiny as the opinionator himself was picking apart the given political policy or issue of the day. It eventually came to a point where I felt that editorial writers were just being stubborn, and that they were clinging to their positions out of some sense of devotion. Although, ultimately, I concluded these people, the political and academic left, to be specific, are simply just not very smart. To the uninitiated, they may seem intimidating in their self-righteous tone, but in reality, far too many of them simply have egos which are larger than their brains. And those among them who would retort by showing off their diplomas and other credentials, I would simply say to them that they have been educated beyond their intelligence and have become too insulated in their ivory towers to reconsider anything. The most widely read newspaper in Sweden is an overtly socialist and anti-Semitic paper known as Aftonbladet. That newspaper's executive interprets the high readership figures as some kind of affirmation that the Swedish people takes it seriously and extends it confidence. I used to read Aftonbladet back when I read papers, but it was not because I had any confidence in its writers or editorial staff. Rather, and I admit with a certain amount of embarrassment, I would read it with the same sick sort of fascination one might have when going to see a circus freak show. When considering every single aspect in which our freedom has been taken away from us, one might at first expect to find an intellectual colossus behind the socialistic powers that be. While perplexed at the given cultural situation and how the state of affairs can be the way that it is in the world, we might expect that someone, somewhere, understands, and that there is some compelling philosophical argument behind it, diligently argued by some cabal of intellectuals who have considered far more things than we have. Therefore, when we finally have the opportunity to confront our philosophical nemesis, it is breathtaking to see what kind of sniveling, boorish, semi-literate nobodies there are who apparently set the agenda for the entire civilized world. One such nobody is a gentleman named Henning Mankell. A few of you will be familiar with him. He is a detective, story novelist, and publisher. In that regard, he does excel in his field, yet he also contributes comments to Aftonbladet. He has the distinction as well as being the son-in-law of the late Swedish film director Ingmar Bergman. Politically, Henning Mankell is, even within the context of the left wing, relegated to the most arrogant yet slobby circles. But in fairness, his appraisal of me is no less unflattering. The last time I had any interaction with him was in November 2007, shortly after the death of former Rhodesian Prime Minister Ian Smith. Now, Ian Smith was definitely a controversial figure, and I did not expect a newspaper like Aftonbladet to be especially kind to him, yet when I saw Henning Mankell's opinion about him, I found it so mindless as to be even beneath him, and I was compelled to reply to him. He wrote vague, sweeping evaluations about how Smith was a terrible racist bigot and that it was dreadful to be black in Rhodesia under his rule. He further claimed that Smith was supported by American racists in the United States and by embargo busters in South Africa. And now the tyrant was dead. He did not refer to a single fact or historical event. He did not give a single rational reason for his position whatsoever. In my response to him, I gave him a list of facts to consider, such as the fact that in 1965, when Rhodesia unilaterally declared independence, it was the only country in Africa in which blacks could vote at all, even at a time when racial conflict lingered in the southern United States. That the material well-being of Rhodesians of all colors was the highest in Africa, and that the country was economically on par with countries like Taiwan and South Korea. There were jobs and apprenticeships for men of all colors, and, rather unique for Africa, enough food to eat every day. As for Smith himself, he was behind new constitutions on no fewer than three occasions, each one serving to speed up the process of democratization. Now, Smith was not perfect, and there was certainly some level-headed opposition to him, but do you think Henning Mankell had any to offer me? Of course not. He refused even to address any of the factual points I raised. Rather, he told me that I was a ridiculous person and that he was disgusted to have to read anything that would come to the defense of Smith. As far as he was concerned, the discussion is over. Is this the sort of intellectual depth of those who are keeping us down? If so, then surely the fault is ours that we continue to live under collectivism. The shallowness of the collectivists is staggering. Their arguments are so easily shot down and so easy to compartmentalize. Regardless of whatever differences might exist between them, they all have certain common notions about the world and about individual freedom.
Somebody wear me to the fair. Sing a lovely flower. child, find me by the stream.
One constant feature of collectivist concern is that of poverty. They demand that poverty as such be solved in an absolute sense, that the very existence of a poor man anywhere for any reason is ipso facto proof that the social system under which he lives is faulty. An ideal situation in which poverty can be minimized and in which those finding themselves in poverty can easily be helped is not good enough for them. Instead, collectivists demand absolutely perfect, while completely ignoring the fact that no collectivist society has ever succeeded in preventing poverty, and that as a rule, poverty is more widespread in countries that are more collectivistic. Indeed, every single conceivable or even purely hypothetical case of some poor fellow stuck out in the desert, barefoot and hungry, not being able to avail himself of help, is taken as the Achilles heel in any free system of government or of a free economy. I have argued tirelessly, not about the money, not even about economics, but the moral case for individual freedom, that one man's real or perceived need does not in itself constitute an obligation on another to that other's detriment, that it is always wrong to initiate the use of force against another human being, that every man has an absolute right to his own life, liberty, and property, that the very purpose of government is to protect our individual freedom of choice, not to restrict it, that forcibly sacrificing some people for the unearned benefit of others is morally reprehensible, and most importantly, such cannot be defended in a truly democratic society. As in a society where all men are equal, no one of us, no member of the demos, can possess a right forcibly to take material values from another, then in a democratic context, No member of the Demos can delegate such a right to a third party, such as the state, to do the stealing on our behalf. Granted, those are points that may be debated, and they are not axioms, but my point is that the shallow collectivists do not even bother to address any of these principles, but rather resort to the "what about the poor fellow who" argument. What about the poor fellow who loses his job and has no money? What then? And let's say there are no jobs available. And let's say he cannot go to another town. And let's say he was only ever trained for that one profession. And let's say he does not have the mental capacity to learn another. And let's say that he has lost his arms, who can't even hunt, fish, plant a garden, or put up a tent. And let's say that there's no charity available to him, since everyone else is having a hard time. Indeed, let's say they're all suffering exactly the same predicaments. And let's say that he has lost his tongue as well, so he could not even ask for help if he wanted. Well, what does that poor fellow do to survive in a free society? You think I'm going over the top? These are exactly the kind of arguments that the collectivists, particularly of the socialist or welfare statist persuasion, keep pushing. It's easy to get sucked into these arguments, but as long as you have an answer to any of these questions that does not entail state intervention and a limitation to personal freedom, more and more postulates will be added until no other answer is possible. Note, however, at that point, the questions stop. If you concede, well, at that point, I suppose the state will have to intervene. There'll be no more questions from the statist. You'll not be asked, what if the state goes broke? Or what if the state becomes corrupt and decides not to help a person of the poor fellow's color, creed, or background? Or even, what about those poor fellows who are too proud or stubborn to ask for state help? As well, unless you are particularly astute, you may feel that you have lost the argument for individual freedom when finally faced with the umpteenth hypothetical example of the poor fellow who, but looking back, none of those hypothetical examples address any aspect of the argument for freedom whatsoever. The poor fellow who does not negate the rights of man, the meaning of representative government, the morality or immorality of initiating force against the other, the concept of all men being equal, or of any other principle fundamental to individual freedom. Yet, being unable to provide for a single hypothetical poor fellow apparently means that those arguments are all null and void. Is the case for freedom such a precarious house of cards that this is enough to bring it all down? It makes me wonder why volumes of socialist theory have been written when the entire killer argument against freedom, what about the poor fellow who, fill in the blank, could fit onto a piece of paper inside a Chinese fortune cookie. Is the poor fellow who really enough to demonstrate the injustice of individual freedom? Or is it rather that there could simply be somewhere, sometime, some poor fellow who finds justice to be inconvenient? While I am talking about important abstractions and moral principles of right and wrong, my detractors, like Henning Mankell and his ilk, accuse me of being obsessed, of all things, with money. I find this obnoxious, since implicit in their entire litany of postulates concerning the poor fellow, it is the notion that the state needs constantly to take money from those who have it and give it to those who don't. They see a society that would allow anyone to go cold and hungry for lack of money as a failed one, but they have no consideration for the many other tragic things that occur in any society. Let me ask them, what would a collectivist society do about the poor fellow who gets hit by a car, or struck by lightning, or falls off a cliff? How is a statist society going to prevent people from drowning, or catching the flu, or choking on a fishbone? We tolerate a statistically insignificant number of unfortunate events to occur without making a social comment on it. Why is it that the collectivists are only up in arms when it is about poverty, and then only hypothetical poverty? Something to do with money. Another article of faith among the intellectually deficient left is the notion that profit is waste. In the past, the Swedish government, like many others in Europe, both operated and paid for many services concerning public well-being, such as health and patient care. Today, the state still pays for the services, but they are more and more being contracted out to private providers. By and large, the state is now paying less, that is to say, a lower price for such services than it did when running the service directly, yet the left is up in arms that the contractors are making a profit. They have the nerve to say that profits are simply stealing tax money, when, of course, tax money is itself already stolen money. Who cares that they're making a profit? The main issue is the price. While still, unfortunately, a socialized system, we as a community, we can now afford to provide health services, which we could not do until recently. But in the eyes of the collectivists, and many Swedish socialists have told me this outright, it would be better to pay, say, $100 to treat an ear infection, as long as the clinic doing the treatment breaks even, than it would be to pay $50 for the same treatment if that means that the private clinic would make a profit of $25. I kid you not, losing money is even better, so they say. The statists object to profit-making enterprises and want to pull funding from them, but those enterprises losing money, be they private or state-run, continue to be propped up and subsidized on the basis of their utility to the community. Truly, concern for the well-being and health of the community and the long-term viability of services is not a concern of the socialists. Indeed, while claiming not to be overly concerned with money, one of the major complaints of the socialists is that many of the health providers in Sweden are registered offshore, and thus the Swedish government cannot tax the profits that are being made. So essentially, when contracting to get the services from such companies at a lower price than they ever could get before, they had anticipated on receiving what would essentially be a forced rebate on the already low prices they're receiving for quality health services. And no, socialists are not concerned with money. Sure. Another thing that characterizes the socialists is what an associate of mine called selfish altruism. What that means is they all want something for nothing, but ostensibly for the sake of someone else. However, it must be universal. They will point to something, usually to the poor, as a reason to implement some kind of redistributive program, but that such a program must then extend to themselves as well. So what a proponent of socialized medicine really is campaigning for is free health care for himself, but he cynically exploits, once again, the caricature of the poor fellow who falls through the cracks in the system in order to play upon the sympathies of the public in pushing forth their agenda. Ironically, it is a sympathy for one's fellow man that the socialists themselves do not possess. How do I know? Well, I cannot read their minds, but past actions give strong indication. Note that central to all the promulgated social programs of the left is the notion of universality, that a program must be egalitarian and cover everyone, even if the rationale behind the program was to alleviate the suffering of relatively few. Everyone is to be inside the safety net without anyone holding it up. Notably, the socialists are resoundingly against helping the poor in those cases where a state of dire need can clearly be demonstrated. If such a person does not fit within some kind of universal program, he does not qualify. Helping just those in a demonstrable need in an emergency is not a socialist aim. They reject helping the poor for the sake of helping the poor, and will not do so if it does not further their political aims of extending the power of the state. In spite of their lofty talk, the left has shown time and time again that they absolutely do not care about people. Whenever a voluntary charity sets up a shop in a community, the leftist members on the municipal councils are the first to oppose them. Efforts to give free food to the hungry out in the street are quickly cleared away on the grounds that they are a nuisance, while the hungry people themselves generally are not. Socialist councillors routinely oppose food banks funded, staffed, and stocked by volunteers. They have opposed charity homeless shelters and missions, while at the same time pressing for funds for so-called affordable housing. On the international level, the left reveals even more of its ugly head, and the truth of their motivations becomes sickeningly apparent. While a malnourished mother often cannot adequately provide nutrition to her baby with her own milk, and given that breastfeeding poses a risk to babies in areas with a high incidence of AIDS, the political left opposed the Nestle company giving away baby formula to mothers in Africa on the grounds that they suspected it of trying to create a dependence among third world populations on Nestle as a multinational company. And never mind that dependence on the government is the very thing they advocate, a government that produces nothing, not even baby formula. Socialists will routinely deny any obsession with money, and decry such generally, while in fact socialism is always about money. They accuse me of only caring about money, yet with every breath, with everything they say, they are talking about taking some people's money away to give to others that have not earned it. Often, not even with a concrete purpose in mind, but merely for egalitarianism in itself as an end. They may be against making money, but they are all for taking money.
Golden brown, texture like sun, lays me down. With my mind she runs throughout the night. No need to fight, never a frown with golden brown. Every time, just like the last, on her ship, tied to the mast, to distant lands, takes both my hands, never a frown with golden brown. Temptress, through the ages she's heading west, from far away, stays for a day, never a frown with golden brown.
My detractors have noticed that while I make a decent living, that I am by no means rich, and indeed, those who have known me for some time remember that I washed dishes in a restaurant for 9 years, for a living. and that I also worked as a substitute teacher in a middle school for several years. Both of these are rather low paid, and so they seem puzzled that I would not support their policies that might result in giving me more of other people's money. Setting aside the moral argument that it is wrong forcibly to take from others, which I don't expect my detractors to appreciate, I can see how such restrictions on the economy and on personal freedom serve to take away my opportunities. I am often accused of not considering the fact that not everyone is smart, not everyone is able, not everyone is lucky enough to lift himself up out of his given situation in his life. I think it is my detractors who are not paying any mind to those who are smart, who are able, and who are lucky enough. And through my detractors' actions and policies, they are actually hurting people and getting in their way. It is a question of means versus ends. Socialists pave a road to hell with intentions of just trying to feed the hungry or just trying to heal the sick, and think that when I oppose them, it is such ends I oppose. It is not. It is their means I oppose. They are means that literally hurt people. And depending what country you live in, these means might be destroying your life. You set yourself up when you say things like, I'm willing to pay tax to help those who really need it. But willingness to pay is never an issue in taxation. The state takes your money by force and will extract it from you no matter how much you protest. If you don't comply, you can go to jail. The reason why any of us, rich or poor, pay taxes is not to feed the thriftless, house the indigent, or heal the improvident, but rather because it is not worth the trouble we would get into if we did not pay. If, after the fact, we can feel good about any of our extorted money being spent on helping other people, the state cynically exploits our good nature and generous spirits in order to increase its power over our lives. But the left does not care, since the people they hurt, so they think, are the rich, or to otherwise people who can withstand it. It serves the real purpose of increasing the power of the state, and while in the long run they do not really help anyone who may truly be in need, well, at least they tried.
You've done it all. Nothing left, all gone and run away. Maybe you'll tarry for a while. It's just a test, a game for us to play. Win or lose, it's hard to smile. Yeah.
This is now the sixth week of VS Sign. I'm very happy to have received so much encouraging response. Given that summer tends to be a period of very little listener feedback generally, I'm delighted to see that I've received about as much as I can handle. Please keep it coming in, however, whether you're a new listener or if you've been writing in often. As long as I know that there are people out there who are interested in VSI, I will continue the program. If you'd like to drop a line, please send email to feedback@vsiradio.org. That's feedback@victorsierraindiaradio.org. VSI Radio International is produced in Sweden exclusively for WBCQ, transmitting from Monticello, Maine, USA on 7,490 kHz. My name is Paul Lambert. I cannot promise to respond personally to every email, but I do read it all, and lately the responses have been so many that I likely will not be responding personally as often as before. Still, I'm happy to get your feedback. Comments and suggestions are most welcome. Questions are also welcome, even contentious questions. I won't, however, entertain debates as such. I'm not here to argue back and forth over the email or over the radio waves. That's not to say I discourage my detractors from having their say. On the contrary, if you think you have something compelling to share, then why not contact WBCQ yourself and get your own program on the air? You can say anything you want, since that's what free speech radio is all about. I've decided that it was time for a bit of a mailbag session here on VSI. Over the past week, I've been getting some great feedback from listeners all over North America, and I really appreciate it. One of the first was from Michael Taniva of Longmeadow, Massachusetts, but who tells me that he's originally from New Zealand. His first letter was just quite short and sweet, just a quick email to say hello, says Michael. Nice start with the inaugural show on WBCQ 7490 kHz, nicely mixed with music and lyrics that reinforce the topic. I would suggest just relaxing a little. The listener needs to laugh and agree with you about the crazy world we live in. Ramsay's Roadhouse makes me laugh and agree with the crazy world. But you're on the right track. Keep it up and good luck. Well, thank you very much, Michael. And maybe I did sound nervous the first time around. I'm not at all new to radio broadcasting, either in English or the Swedish languages. What I am new is to all the technical computer and recording equipment, and perhaps I was a bit nervous on how to work everything. But I think I'm getting the hang of it, so I hope, Michael, you'll continue to listen and continue to write in. I should mention that Michael has taken advantage of the free ebook offer that I have on right now. If you'd be interested in receiving a copy of Our Enemy, the State by Albert Nock, please say so in an email addressed to feedback@vsiradio.org and say you'd like this free ebook. It's yours free for the asking. I will send you the link and you can download it at your leisure. Let's not forget another excellent listener, Jim Tyner from upstate New York. And I'll tell you, Jim, he picks up on absolutely everything that is said and is broadcast here on VSI Radio. And he's sent me quite a lot of email over the past few weeks. In one of his earlier emails, he referred to a Dobelli piece that was when we covered the topic of staying away from mainstream news and news altogether. I cited an article from Rolf Dobelli, which I encourage you to look up yourselves. And Jim writes, "Dear Paul, I wanted you to know that I downloaded the Dobelli piece that was the subject of the broadcast. What a find. I'm converted. Thanks again." Now, Jim later told me that he's been off news for several weeks, and good luck to you, Jim, as well. A little bit about Jim. He tells me that he's about 45 miles west of the city of Albany in a small town called Richmondville. He's been a shortwave listener since college in the mid-80s and a ham since 2002. Jim suggests a few future show topics. He'd like to hear me comment on things like homesteading, reskilling, appropriate technology, communitarianism, a new paradigm for idea-based broadcasting using shortwave stations like WBCQ, as opposed to advertising-driven opinion and talk radio, improving the life of the mind through reading and sound philosophy, and any other topics promoting a return to sanity in general. Well, thank you very much, Jim. I'll certainly look into many of those topics. I am interested in quite a few of them. And I'll just have to return to sanity myself first before I'm able to give any good comment in that regard. What may be interesting to many American listeners is a bit of a cultural clash that Jim and I experienced here. Now, I've lived in a few places in the world, and including in Canada, so I'm not completely unfamiliar. Canada and the United States, they're alike in many ways, but not in all ways. So this cultural clash between myself and Jim was something that was a bit new to me. When he was kind enough to send a photograph of him and his family from Niagara Falls, it was a perfectly kind gesture, and I really appreciated it. I did mention to Jim, though, that that's a level of intimacy that is not really shared among strangers in Europe, so I was surprised, but by no means was I offended. I think that's absolutely lovely, and I wish people would be a little more open with each other in that regard. So thank you for that as well, Jim. Speaking of Canada, I would be remiss in not mentioning a new writer, I should say a new listener, who wrote me an email. This is from Fred in Ottawa, Canada. Fred didn't give his last name, but that's okay. Thank you for writing in. And Fred writes, "Hi, good show. I think you've already taken first place as the most cerebral show on WBCQ. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's quite a pedestal to live up to. I was fading in and out a bit here in Ottawa, CSSR. Maybe Brother Scare is in second place now. Do you actually get over the air reception there? Well, yeah, Brother Scare. Well, I won't say too much about him right now. I can get WBCQ over the air in Sweden, where I am, very occasionally. I have to climb up out of the valley, get on top of the hill, and with my handheld realistic DX380 portable receiver, in the wintertime, I could pick up Ramsey's Roadhouse back on 7415, as it was, I think, it was more than a year ago now when they made the switch. I've not been able to pick up off the air on 7490 as a rule, but sometimes I do get lucky, usually in time for Brother Stare. But typically I listen over the internet radio for obvious reasons. Now, Fred and I were talking a little about Canadian music, and it turns out, Fred continues, I gave up on Canadian music around 1975. Paradoxically, too much American, especially African music, not sure what I know what he means, and too much CanCon. How many times can one listen to Joni Mitchell, Free Man in Paris, before saturating? Well, when I was in Canada, I got a bit sick of sign everywhere, a sign, but certainly Free Man in Paris gets its more than its share of play on Canadian radio. For those who aren't familiar, CanCon, that's a sort of portmanteau of Canadian content, and the Canadian Radio and Telecommunications Commission, which is their answer to the FCC, I suppose, mandates basically micromanages the use of the airwaves in Canada, and they demand a certain percentage of airtime be devoted to Canadian content, so Canadian music and other such materials. As a result, I've noticed that Canadians are very unfamiliar with a lot of music from abroad, and a lot of the music I would play on this show. Now, Fred continues, and I guess this is a bit tongue-in-cheek, at least I hope so. If I ever become the dictator of the Kanuckistan Soviet, one of my first proclamations would be to limit radio and TV advertising to 8 minutes per hour. The stations would actually be better off. Supply and demand would allow them to raise the price per minute of commercial, and the marginal advertisers would have to go elsewhere. Also, I'd break up the corporate monopolies. We have a few corporations across the country controlling almost all the big city radio stations. Some of them own 6 radio stations, plus a TV station, plus many specialty cable channels in one city. Now, see, this seems to be a topic that both the right and the left seem to be completely in agreement with, and I'm totally not in agreement. This idea of we need the government to break up monopolies and get involved in the economy just to make sure it stays free. You know, forcing a free economy is a bit of a contradiction in terms. But I'm not dogging you, Fred. Disagreement is certainly allowed. I mean, in fact, it's really on our side, on the freedom side, the good side, where there is any debate at all. The left wing is solidly behind their positions and solidly behind their politicians, and there's no debate there at all. So debate away. Come on, bring it on. And please write in again, Fred. Thank you very much for your email. Oh, before, I should point out that Fred ends off with, the shortwave bands in North America are littered with religious hucksters. There's Pastor Melissa Scott, formerly of the porn business, talking ad infinitum about the tithing principle, giving, Galatians 6:6. Apparently there's a first tithe, second tithe, and third tithe, as well as first fruits in January and double portion in July. Haha, you don't know what you're missing. She's on 24/7 on one transmitter and close to 24/7 on another. Well, I'm not missing that at all, Fred. Melissa Scott, the widow of late Jean Scott, her university network broadcasts out of a transmitter in Anguilla. It has a daytime frequency and a nighttime frequency. Early in the daytime is the best time to hear it, and you can hear it all the way here in deep in the Swedish forest. I don't have so much of an opinion on... I'm not familiar, I don't think, with any of her earlier pornographic work, but I definitely recognize the name, and I have heard her show. I would be remiss as well in not mentioning David O. of Sherbrooke, Quebec, Canada, who is always in contact with me and is some great inspiration behind my show, as well as Ramsey, down in Monticello, Indiana, the host of Ramsey's Roadhouse on Monday nights at 7, and I encourage everyone to tune in. Right now he's running yet another one of his shortwave radio giveaways, so tune in 7490, Mondays at 7 p.m. Eastern, and listen to Ramsey's Roadhouse. Now, if you'll forgive me, I may treat you to an extended finale this evening and cut the monologue a bit short. I think I have beat the topic of tonight's discussion to death, and I feel I want to quit while I'm ahead. Remember that if you would like to send feedback to VSI Radio International or to request your free ebook, Our Enemy the State, please send your email to feedback@vsiradio.org. That's feedback@victorsierraindiaradio.org. I'd be delighted to hear from you. And so ends another episode for this week. I hope you'll join me once again when I return next Wednesday at this time on WBCQ. This is Paul Lambert wishing you all a good night.
If you've enjoyed this presentation, visit www.justrightmedia.org for more programming that's not right-wing, it's just right.